Blog Talk Radio.
Of the Storm, and we're sorry about that. Had a little issue, but hey, welcome to another edition of the Story Blender. Of course, hosted by author Stephen James. Today's guest on the show is going to be none other than special guest Lisa Cron, who is publishing industry, worked in the publishing industry, served as a literary agent, was a producer for Showtime and Court TV, as well as many other story consultants for other projects and TV stations, shows, and things like that. And one of her books is called, her groundbreaking book is called Wired for Story. Stephen is also going to be co-hosting with, she's been here for the last couple shows. Her name is Pam Johnson. She is the one, she's encouraged the development of story through her work as a freelance editor and a community theater director. She has known Stephen for many years. She's helped edit all of his 14 novels, and she's also been his office manager for the last 8 years. So her and Stephen have become quite the team together over the past 8 years. And again, we want to also let you know that all the shows here on Suspense Radio are brought to you by Kensington Books. Make sure you go to kensingtonbooks.com for more information on their authors and their upcoming releases, and of course, all their past releases. All their information should be there. Go to kensingtonbooks.com. And of course, another reminder is to go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, so all the new episodes go right into your listening device, wherever you listen to it, and you're able to get those as soon as they're done, and then you can listen to them however you normally listen to it. So without any further ado, let's hit it right over here with Stephen, and take it away, Stephen. Here you go.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Pam Johnson.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. Our guest today is the author of a book that many of you may have already heard of. It's called Wired for Story: The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers from the Very First Sentence. And our guest, the author, Lisa Cron, has worked in the publishing industry, served as a literary agent, as a producer for Showtime and Court TV, as well as a story consultant for Warner Brothers and Village Roadshow Productions. Her specialty is guiding writers to develop stories that tap into the way that our brains process stories, and I am really looking forward to tapping into her brain. Lisa, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. I couldn't be happier to be here.
You know, years ago, I was getting a master's degree in storytelling, and I think it was 96. I was mainly doing my research. There's like 50 people in the world that had a master's in storytelling, and I thought that sounded like the most fun master's degree program ever.
Yeah.
And so when I was doing the research for my thesis, I came across the people at the time who were leading artificial intelligence research in the world were saying, if we ever want to have strong AI, artificial intelligence, we need to teach the machine not to think in arithmetic or math or zeros and ones, but in story. Because that's how humans think and process stuff.
Right.
And so, yeah, as I was looking through your book, I was thinking back to that, and I thought, man, I think they were onto something 20 years ago.
I think that's such a great thing to say, and I think you're 100% right, and that's why AI, I don't think, works. And I think that that's also something, it's a great way kind of to launch into what I think at the end of the day tends to be the biggest mistake that writers make, and that is that they start writing their story from page one of the story or of the novel. And when it comes to what AI lacks, and kind of the logic that it works on, is that it lacks any kind of actual memory that gives meaning to what's happening. And that's what people miss, is that stories actually all begin and media res, meaning in the middle of the thing, and that means that the story itself has been happening for probably as many pages as it's going to actually be in the novel, and that the way the characters, and you know, primarily the protagonist, is going to see things and is going to want what they want and be afraid of what they're afraid of comes from what happened before. Because, and I mean, just going to like AI and the way we as human beings make sense of things, you know, we're kind of taught, and it seems like 100% logical, that, you know, you look at the world and we all kind of see the same, you know, general, quote unquote, if you could see my hands, like making air quotes, objective world out there. You know, we all read the same meaning into things, you know, except for people who are like really, really screwed up, and we hope that they get a lot of therapy and then, you know, join us over here in real reality. And it turns out that is not at all how anyone ever makes sense of anything. There's a fabulous book called Louder Than Words, The New Science on How the Mind Makes Meaning by a guy named Benjamin K. Bergen. And he talks about the fact that you know, when scientists were looking into, okay, well, where did language come from? And how are we making sense of things? And is this something we're kind of just born with, or is it something that we see objectively and then figure out? And what they've discovered is that we make meaning and we look at the world around us, and the meaning that we ascribe to the things that happen to us comes from one thing and one thing only, and that is what our past experience has taught us those things mean. And that means when you're writing a story, because the story isn't just about the plot, it's not just about, you know, the things that happen, because there's nothing more boring than that, it's about how those things are affecting someone based on what they enter the story already wanting, and based on what I like to call these days the misbelief, the thing that's been holding them back, and then that is the lens through which they view everything that happens from page one on. And in fact, because so much of the stories are about how we solve a problem and then change, that problem and the change we need to go through has been brewing for an awfully long time before we get to page one. So that is what writers really need to pay attention to first, again, because it's the way we make sense of things. And it's why AI could never work, because it never gets the nuance. And again, the nuance isn't a general nuance. Each one of us views things based on our own subjective nuance, and that is based on, you know, our past. As Faulkner so brilliantly said, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. And that's where story comes from, and why I don't know that AI would ever work. Because all of us see things subjectively, you know. I mean, even if there is an objective reality out there, how would we know it? Because everything we know through our five senses and based on our experience. So I think it's a miracle when we ever actually really do communicate and kind of not to sound, but I think a lot of the time when we think we do, we probably are agreeing for very different reasons. Anyway, so...
Yeah, no, that's... That's good. And when you said, okay, so a mistake that we make sometimes is writing from page one and so on. So what does it look like to do it differently? What does it look like to do it in a way that really connects with the way that our brain processes reality and story? In other words, I'm going to sit down and write a novel. If I don't start on page one, what do I do?
Well, what you do, and just to kind of leap back for 1 second to talk about what a story actually is and what's actually hooking us, and then that will get us to, okay, here's what you do. And what hooks us when we're reading anything is the way the main character, the protagonist, is making sense of what's happening to them, because they're in a difficult situation, and they have to take action immediately, always, because story is about, and you say this, you know, it's about that tension. It's about the what am I going to do? And if it's not driven by conflict and tension, it's just a bunch of things that happen, and no one cares. And the place where that tension and conflict manifests isn't just in external things that happen, but it's in how the character is analyzing it and trying to figure out and struggling, what should I do based on what my agenda is and what I want, and based on this thing that's holding me back, and based on what I want other people to think, because that's, you know, also a big part of it. So since that's really what story is about, in other words, story is about, and this is a definition of story that I use in Wired for Story, and I actually have a new book coming out in August called Story Genius, and It's a story is about how what happens, which is the plot, and that's just the surface of the story, affects someone, and that's the protagonist, so everything that happens in the plot is going to get its meaning and emotional weight based on how it's affecting the protagonist in pursuit of a difficult goal, which is both external and external, but also that, you know, that big plot, overarching plot goal, and how they change as a result. And that internal change in the protagonist is what the story is actually about. It's about an internal change, that aha moment, and that's what allows them to either, you know, solve the problem at the end or not have the aha and not solve it, as that the movie Blue Jasmine is about someone who doesn't have the aha moment and ends up, you know, imploding at the end. But so to get back to what a writer would do then, it means that every protagonist enters a story with two things already fully formed, and that is something that they want and have wanted for a very long time, and this misbelief, this thing that's been holding them back. So when I work with novelists, you know, the first thing they do, provided that they're starting from scratch, and often even if they're in the third or fourth draft, you know, is to go back and go, okay, you know, what is your what if? What are you writing about? What is this change this character is going to go through? Then who is this character? Who is this the protagonist? Because that is going to be your reader's avatar in the novel. I mean, the truth is, when we read it, it anesthetizes that part of your brain that even knows it is a story, and you're experiencing what that main character is experiencing. And that's not a metaphor. That's a fact. The things that they go through travel the same neural pathways that if you were actually doing it, you know, those events would travel. So we're really feeling what they're feeling. So the question is, you know, what is that misbelief? Because I think stories are predominantly about how a character overcomes a misbelief. And to kind of clarify what a misbelief is, because, you know, I mean, we've all, as writers, heard that term fatal flaw. You know, character enters with a fatal flaw. And I don't like that term because it sounds so, you know, pejorative, you know, like finger waggy, so judgy, like you have a flaw and hopefully this is going to excuse you of it. Mm-hmm. You know, or the flip side is they'll say, well, a character enters with a wound that needs to be healed. And I think that flips it the other way, like they're a victim. I like to use the term misbelief. Misbelief is something that almost always comes early in life, and it's something that probably saved the character at that, or the protagonist, or the character, you know, at that point where something was going wrong. Somehow now they've decided that this is how the world works, and then that misbelief is what guides them, you know, through their life, and every kind of big turning point decision that they make in their lives when their lives take a change is guided by this misbelief. And of course, it's always struggling with the desire and the thing that they want. And so I have writers go back and trace it. I call it the origin scene. What is the misbelief, and specifically, where did it come from? And again, a lot of this is writing. They're writing actual scenes where we're actually in the character's head as this happens. So it's not just doing that thing that writers do that I think ends up hurting more than helping, which is doing those really long character bios that are, you know, like 10 miles wide and an inch deep, so that, you know, you could wade in their deepest revelations and you wouldn't get your ankles wet, because they're all about what happens and not about why. So then by tracing that misbelief up to when the plot kicks in, and the goal of the plot is to force the character to go after that thing they've always wanted, but to have to face their misbelief in order to do it. And that is that internal struggle. And it's very specific. It's, you know, I think we both know stories are about one single problem that complicates. One external problem, that's the plot, and one internal problem, that's the struggle between the misbelief and the desire that predates the plot, which is why you could probably have a bunch of different, very different plots that would tell the same internal story. So basically that's, and I'll tell you something, I don't know if you've had this experience talking to writers, but sometimes it's surprising that things that we take for granted when we read without thinking about it, it's very difficult to know it when we turn around and write. As Flannery O'Connor, I think, so brilliantly said, I find most people know what a story is until they sit down to write one. And that's not because they're, you know, there's something, they're not smart enough. It's because, again, our brain is anesthetized when we're reading. I remember teaching a class at UCLA with novels, people who were in, you know, most of them were revising a second or third draft, and I asked them, I said, okay, what does your character enter the story wanting? And not a single person could answer, and several were surprised at the question.
Yeah, that's so, just crazy because that's the first thing I ask people to.
Exactly.
It's like, what does he want?
it's stunning, but the whole point is, when you think about anything that you're reading or watching, it's, you know, what does the story have to do? It has to make you curious immediately. And the curiosity isn't just what's going to happen externally. It's why is that going to matter to the character internally, given what they want and given what's at stake? I often think of story as, you know, an emotional cost-benefit analysis of taking a particular course of action. So it's, why does it matter to that character? And that comes back to what they want. And if they don't want anything, why would you pay any attention? Because then there's nothing to root for. There's no meaning to anything.
That's interesting, Lisa, because I do a lot of theater, and our artistic director always tells us as directors, always make sure your character knows what they want, what their motivation is when they enter the stage, when they enter the scene, and where they're going when they leave it. And so it definitely translates to any story form, this motivation.
Exactly. It's what do they want and why do they want it? Because to me, it all comes back to the why. And it's really tracing it all the way back to why. And the why is always something specific that happened to them in the past. And it's not specific. I think one place that writers run into trouble, because the difference between, I think, theater and movies and TV and prose is that prose can take us to that one place that, that those other two can't, which is what's someone really thinking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's really going on beneath the surface? I often think of stories, the difference between what we say out loud and what we're really thinking when we say it, because, you know, how often are those two things the same? You know, which one's more interesting and juicier?
Yeah.
And in a play or in, you know, in a TV show or movie, you can't necessarily give us access to that in any sort of a consistent way, or else you got tons of voiceover, or, you know, they're just telling, so it doesn't really work. But in novels, it comes back to that why, and the why is really specific. And a problem I think writers have is they'll sum it up in general. Well, the reason why he's doing it is because he's got abandonment issues. And I always think, okay, well, show me the person who doesn't have abandonment issues, and I'll show you the person who hasn't figured it out yet. We've all got abandonment issues. but what does that specifically mean to them, meaning what specifically happened, meaning, again, write the scene? Because the problem when people extrapolate it in general is that, think about what a general is. A general is something that where, like, for instance, let's say it was you, and you said, I have abandonment issues. Now, you came to that general based on years of very specific experience. So if I said to you, what do you mean by abandonment? You could sit down and go, do you have a week? You know, and you would tell me every specific thing that happened to you and what that meant. And your idea of abandonment issue and mine might be very, very different. And so the story is always in the specific. The irony is that the only way to get to the universal and to make someone feel love, hate, anger, jealousy, is to go to the very, very, very specific in a story as to how that's manifesting in a specific person, in a specific situation, given their lives. But when you're writing, and this is what I think kind of can throw writers off, is that it's the other way around. We start with the general, because that's inherently where you start, because you don't have much. And then you're digging down, down, down into the specific of that character and how it's going to manifest for them. Because it'll be different for everybody. And again, if it isn't specific, it can't move forward. A general has no legs. It just sits there because you can't, you know, if someone says, I want true love, and now they're going out in the world, you're thinking, I don't know what's at stake. I don't know how they get true love. I don't know what true love means to them. I don't. And now we're lost. So it always comes back to the specific and knowing, you know, as you were just saying, Pam, the specific motivation and where that came from. And the other reason why it really helps to go back, and I think is essential, and write a lot of these scenes that happen before the novel begins is because those are the thoughts that are going to go through the character's head as they're trying to figure out what to do in the moment. You know, that's where that comes from, that very specific, you know, in your own lives, of, you know, anybody's life. When someone asks you, you know, do you want to do something or what do you think about that, what you do is your brain automatically rips through all of your past experience to go, okay, in this situation, what's safe and what isn't? And given my agenda and what I want in the future, what should I admit to here? We're always trying to figure that out. What should I really admit to and what should I keep inside? And that's where all of this work that you know that writers need to do before they get to page one, that's not only what gets them to page one, because with all of us, you know, how did we get to anybody who's listening? Think about where you are in your life right now, and how did you get there? Through all of the decisions you made in the past and the reasons you made those decisions. Character steps on the page, they've already got that. That's how they got to where they got to begin with. But, and the point is that all this work that you do before, I had one writing instructor tell me once, I said, yeah, you got to do all this work. And she said, I could never tell my students to do that. They just want to start writing. And I wanted to say, well, what is that, like chopped liver? Like, what are you talking about? That is writing, and that then leaps into the novel, again, in the form of the memories that go through the character's mind as they're trying to figure out what to do, and in flashbacks, and in backstory, which is really, if you start looking at it, you'll see it's often on every page of the novel. But again, because when we're reading, we're so deeply in the story, we don't see it. And I think that's another place that steers writers wrong naturally, which is, you know, when you're deep in a story, there are two things, and it feels like real reality, because it is real reality. It is, you know, traveling those neural pathways. But there are those two things that you can still see, and that is the beautiful writing. You know, you love the writer's voice and the plot. Because at the end, you know, when you're talking about it, we think in story, we think in visual images. So you can see that plot. So it's very easy to think, okay, to write something, I just need to learn to write really beautifully and to come up with a plot. And then, and this is what kills me, and then if I have the talent, I'll unleash my creativity and, you know, and the story is going to appear. And it doesn't happen that way. But the killer thing is there are a lot of people who might be great writers, but because they haven't really harnessed, okay, what is the story, they end up thinking, I have no talent. And very often it doesn't have that much to do with that kind of talent. It has to do with really kind of harnessing what a story is and then going forward from there, if that makes sense.
Yes,
yeah, and
Lisa, go ahead, Steve.
go ahead, Pam.
We'll fight over it. Lisa, I work as a freelance editor, and some of my authors have been told by agents that the agent can't connect with the protagonist. There's
right.
just, like, no relationship there. So do you think if these authors go back and think through some of the emotions and the backstory, so to say, that would come out more at the beginning of the story to help these agents relate to the protagonist?
Absolutely. I mean, because I remember when I worked as an agent, and you'd go, you know, talking to, you know, in writer's groups, and they'd say, well, how much does an agent read, you know, before they, you know, to get a feel for it, before they decide to stop reading? And it always seemed like it's such an illogical question, because the answer is so obvious. They read until they read until they realize that this is not going to grab me, and often that is a page. Yeah, 100%. You have to get that onto the page on page one. We have to have some idea, not just what's happening, but why it matters to the protagonist, what their agenda is and what they're struggling with on page one. And whether you're writing a thriller or a literary novel or anything in between, it's almost always there. I often use the Elizabeth George, I would say the name of the book because it also sort of gives it away, but she, in fact, there's a great, Stanley Fish wrote an op-ed in the Times, the New York Times once, talking about, you know, running through an airport and needing a book to read and loving mysteries, which is also the genre I love. So I was like, oh, I love reading this. And he said, I was going to pick it based on the first sentence. And and he does. And it's funny because in the piece, he doesn't name the three books. So it's like, wait, what book is this? I just happened to be in a bookstore once looking, and I pulled it off and went, oh, my God, that's the sentence, which was Joel Campbell, age 11 at the time, began his descent toward murder with a bus ride. And it just immediately pulls you in because, you know, I get where this is going. And the interesting thing, and the book is called What Came Before He Shot Her, which, of course, also, you know, kind of lets you know that the murder is going to be of a woman. But the interesting thing is that murder doesn't happen. It's like, I think it's a 732-page book. It's really long. And I think the murder happens on page 600, and it's never referenced again. If you redacted that first sentence, you wouldn't read any further because you'd go, I don't understand the point of this. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know why I'm following this kid. Even though you really, really like him, it's that yardstick that, yeah, I get where this is going, and I understand what the character is struggling with. But all of that needs to be right there in the first few pages, or why would anybody read forward? I mean, that's a big mistake that writers make, is they kind of assume that the reader is just going to care. You know, it's almost like once you read page
right.
one, now you're obligated to read to the end, and it just, you know, it couldn't be less true. You have to make them care, but that doesn't mean your character has to be, you know, likable, which is another big mistake that people make, is I'm going to make them likable, and that means, you know, that they've got no conflict. And they're just nice
right.
to everybody all the time. And you're going, okay, not only isn't that it, but the truth is people who are just nice to people all the time and don't seem to have any problems, we don't really like them.
No. They're
like
boring.
In one of my classes, I said, we don't want to read stories about nice people doing nice things. We want to read stories about conflicted people doing difficult things.
Right. Because
and I remember when I said it, like this light went on over the course of the students at this writer's seminar. They're like, oh, I've been thinking about it all backwards.
Yeah. It's so true. And it's weird the way we get that. Cause, and when you think about it, everybody's conflicted. Our surface goal, I once had a student who said, and I've quoted it ever since because it was just so perfect. She said, I know on the surface I look really put together, and she really did. I know on the surface I look really put together, she said, but inside I'm a raging mess, and I'm trying to keep all of you from seeing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's where the story lives, because everybody's
true.
A raging mess, and the
yeah.
more perfect they seem on the outside, the more you wonder what they're doing in the basement, you know?
Exactly. So, yeah, so good. So, Lisa, I wanted to ask about the idea of change with characters, because you mentioned it earlier, and I think it runs through your book, and it runs through a lot of the teachings of different people mm-hmm. that I've read, and there are some story theorists who believe that mm-hmm. stories are there to change characters, some that stories are there to reveal characters. And over the course of the last 5 years, I guess I've been trying to sort out where I land on that continuum. And at least personally, I think that if a story is centered mainly on an external struggle, say a James Bond movie, Jack Reacher
right.
Story, or Sherlock Holmes or something like that, that where the most promise is, that's where the most change should occur. So in other words, if the most promise of change or transformation is externally, like the situation has to get stopped, the bomb has to, you know, be the terrorists stopped
right.
and so on, then that's where the most change, we'll expect the most transformation in that arena, you know, whether it's internal, interpersonal, or external. But my question kind of relates to, first of all, what's your thought about that, revealing versus a changing, and how does change occur in series characters? Does that still apply, in your view, with a series character, say like Jack Reacher? Because I know
right.
Lee Child is very specific. He says, my character does not change.
Right, right. And he reveals things about him. No, I know.
Yeah.
I read The Killing Floor. And he
yeah.
reveals a lot about Reacher in that. And that's a really interesting distinction, because I have two answers, or two different arenas for that. One is, yeah, I think on that level, the more we reveal, because what we're interested in is why. The character's doing this why. And as I recall, on The Killing Floor, he does reveal a good bit of why Jack Reacher thinks what he does. And
yeah.
and that is really something, because what we're wondering is, I see what he's doing, I need to know why. So, yeah, I think that in most stories there is some kind of a change, because that's what we want. But a reveal on that level of, and what you're talking about is, here's the what, you're going to reveal the why to me, that's what we come from. So I think that also
yeah.
could 100% work. Of course, I firmly believe that the writer needs to know what that's going to be from the beginning, because now they're writing toward it. But I also think let's take series where, like a Sherlock Holmes or something, where the character like is 100% never going to change. I think that in that case, that change, while it's not necessarily internal, it does come to the real, oh, I'm so glad you said that. That's really kind of fascinating, because
yeah.
both of those things revolve around, I see what you're doing, I want to know why. And I think as long as it's got that and that slowly revealed, it's the same thing. It is that change. And the change is, I see what a person has done, meaning the perp. I just use the word perp because I don't know what else to use when you're thinking
yeah.
of a thriller. Or a, you know, so perp just seems like a multi-purpose word for it. But we want to know, you know, I see what they did. I want to know why they did it. Now, that doesn't mean they're ever going to change. But we want to know the why. And often, and what we're hoping is the why is going to knock something that we think on its ass, basically. You know, tell me something I didn't know. It looked like they were doing it for this reason, and now you're going to show me a very different way of looking at it, and I hadn't thought of that before. Because what we're wired to come to story for is that kind of inside intel. You know, that great line in Citizen Kane where he goes, you know, nothing's ever more interesting than finding out what makes people tick. And that comes back to that why. And I think in a thriller, often what we're looking for is, why did that character, meaning the perp, why did they do what they did? What drove them to it? Because I don't think it's ever just an external puzzle.
No, I don't think so, you know.
Yeah.
When I write my series character, Patrick Bowers, he's an FBI agent who kind of consults in geospatial investigative techniques, anyway, helps consult on tracking serial arsonists, killers, and so on. Mm-hmm. So in each book, there is a huge external struggle, obviously. Catch the killer or stop the arsonist or the terrorist, whatever it might be. But I also have an internal struggle, and the way I like to frame it, instead of a theme, I always try to ask myself, what's the question or moral dilemma that's driving the story? Yeah.
I hate the word theme. I think I use the word point. What's the point? What are you saying about human nature?
Yeah.
What is your point? And that's where, when I was talking about, okay, what's your misbelief? And now what is going to force that aha moment? Because, you know, with any kind of a misbelief, we want to hold on to it because we don't think of it as a misbelief. We think of it as true. And that's how stories escalate. And I could not agree with you more. You know, your book, Story Trumps
Structure.
Trumps
structure.
It's so true. I even think when they talk about story structure books, I think that's a misnomer because it's what they're really talking about is plot structure. And a plot by itself is just a bunch of things that happen. Who cares? It's story structure, and I couldn't agree with you more about the fact that where did three-act structure, how did that become the thing? I think that leads, you know, that leads writers astray, and you're constantly battling with it. No, but where does act one end, and where does it, like, just forget about that. You know, story structure is the byproduct of a story well told.
Yeah.
Story creates structure.
You know, the whole three-act thing kind of comes from Aristotle's Poetics, where he talks about an event that originates the rest of the events, and then the middle event that's caused by it, and finally the conclusive or resolution, conclusive event or the resolution. In other words, he's saying that, so people look at that and they're like, oh, beginning, middle, and end, but they're not reading in the context. He's talking about the causal nature, the contingent nature of stories, which is something I really appreciated in your book. You really emphasize this cause and effect, and that's exactly what he was trying to point out in Poetics. There is an origination, there is a conclusive event, and within that, everything is causally related. And so people, on a cursory reading of Aristotle, kind of say, oh, beginning, middle, and an end, it's three acts. It's like, no, you're missing the whole point. He's talking about how a story originates, moves through escalating conflict toward a conclusive event after which nothing else logically makes sense within that story.
Exactly.
And
I love that. I was noticing that you had that in Story Trump structure, the idea of, it's both unexpected and yet completely what actually had to happen at the end.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. It's like Norman Krasner surprise them with what they expect. You know, it's inevitable by the time you get to the end, and yet it surprises you as well. That's exactly the way to go. But it comes back to that same, you know, as you were saying, it's cause and effect all the way through, but it isn't inevitable until you get to the end and you're looking back. Going forward, it could go different ways. But it
Pam, what was that one quote that someone recently sent to us? What do you call it? Not predictable, post-dictable.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Post-dictable. I'm trying to remember what book that was from, but there was an author who coined the term post-dictable, that when you get to that point and look back, you're like, yeah, I could have predicted, but of course you couldn't beforehand. And I love that because, to me, that's at the essence of a twist. And a twist, of course, I look at it as giving readers what they didn't know they want. So they want that twist, but they didn't know it until they get it, and they realize it's what they wanted all along.
So, Lisa, there's a lot of debate out there about, and it goes along with this, about predictable, post-predictable, but about outlining, some debate, organic versus outlining. What are your views on that?
Oh, I have really strong views. and I think you're talking about, like, pantsers or plotters.
Right.
Are you someone who does the plot, or are you someone who just – and I think both schools are equally damaging. I think they're both awful.
Hmm.
And the reason is, I think pantsing is the worst of all. I think that that comes from that idea that, you know, you learn to write well, and then you kind of get some, you know, basic idea, and then you just start writing, and it's going to come to you. And that, I think, is completely impossible because, again, a character makes decisions based on who they are when they walk onto page one. If you don't know who that person is, it's like saying, I'm going to write a 300-page novel about the most important turning point in someone's life who I know absolutely nothing about. It's like, how could you even do that? And then, you know, by the time you get to the end, they've just done a bunch of things. Even if you figured some of it out by the end, that means everything that's happened up to that point is now completely moot, because now they would be a different person there on page one. So I think pantsing is just the worst. And I think the reason it's out there is because it feels good, and we like things that feel good. It feels good. I can just sit down and I can just, you know, NaNoWriMo, I'll just start writing. And also I think that writing sometimes is often taught, especially in MFA programs, by really, really accomplished writers who have, and there are people, I met an 11-year-old girl recently who was like this, who just had a natural sense of story. They could, in fact, do it. They are few and far between. And so because it comes naturally to them, they've never had to deconstruct it. They have no idea what they're doing, and they do think that it's the beautiful language and then are having a way with words. I mean, what does that even mean? You know, words and language is there as a vessel to communicate meaning, and it's the story that gives it the meaning. The problem with outlining is that people just outline the plot, and that starts on page one. And it's just a bunch of things that happen. And at the end of the day, the story's not about the plot. It's about how the plot affects the protagonist. And that means there's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to know before you can begin any kind of an outline. So I think anything on that level that basically starts on page one going forward is inherently gonna lead the writer astray, unless they do have this natural sense of story. And I mean, it's hard to say, but if they do, chances are they're already really successful because they're kind of few and far between. I mean, so at the end of the day, even when writers go, okay, I need to know a little bit of backstory before I can start plotting, or I need to know a little bit of backstory before I start pantsing, what they tend to think of is this very general stuff. Well, she had a rough childhood, and her parents split up when she was 11, and she had to move around a lot, and then she dropped out of school, and, you know, and then she had a drug problem, and now she's trying to make it back, but she finds out she's pregnant. Okay, I know the backstory, now I'll go forward. And that's not enough by any stretch. Mm-hmm. It's really developing that other stuff. So honestly, I think both schools by themselves lead to nothing but heartbreak, and I don't say it lightly. I've been reading, you know, manuscripts for longer than I would admit to being alive. and that's what tanks most books, and most manuscripts are really, you know, are pretty bad. I mean, you know, when I worked as an agent, I felt like, you know, in fact, when I first started teaching at UCLA Extension, it was a class called Your Perfect Pitch Package, which they picked the title, not me. I was teaching that class. But I really wanted to, because I brought in actual query letters, because I knew it would make people feel good.
Yeah, no kidding.
Most of them were so, I would say, you know, they might as well, you know, they could have been written in crayon, and some of them were. It was just, but people don't want to put in the work. I don't mean they don't want to. I mean, it feels like if you're an artist, you can just sit down and you can kind of do it. And it's hard to be a writer. Writing a novel is hard. It's not an easy thing, and it's painful, and you're tapping into your own self because, you know, all those things that your characters believe, you know them. They come from you in some way. So it's digging really down and not holding back, and it's just, it's not an easy thing, and it takes work. But I sort of feel like if you want to be a writer, you have to dig down there the same way you wouldn't go to a doctor who said, you know, I think I have this feel for medicine. I've never really done an appendectomy before, but, you know, I'm going to wait because I just feel like I can, I know my way through. Or an airline pilot, you know. I mean, you want someone who's really put in the time and understands what it is and then is really willing to work it. Because it is hard, and I think that's the other big problem out there is that, you know, I mean, and we're wired. We're wired to want to do things easily. We're wired to want to do things as quickly as possible because the way that our brains are wired, I mean, we're really wired to live in a world we don't live in anymore. We're wired to live in a world where, you know, if you made it to tomorrow, you were doing really, really good. So that's why I think when people go, I don't understand why, you know, why can't we understand that if we do this now in 5 years, we're going to, you know, if I eat nothing but pastrami sandwiches now in 5 years, I'm going to have a heart attack. And it's like, because all there is right now, and I want the pastrami sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
So the same thing is true of writing. If it seems easy, well, then why not do it that way? And so I think a lot of I hate to say it, but it feels like there's a lot of instruction out there, you know, write a novel in 10 minutes a day that makes it seem super easy.
Oh, no, I completely agree, which is one of the reasons we have this show. You know, I think those are destructive. I know I meet people who are like, yeah, I wrote my novel in a month or something. I'm sitting there saying, you what? Yeah,
yeah.
We wrote like 3,000 words a day or whatever it was. And I honestly, I'm like, I'm sure it's unreadable. It can't be readable because there is no, I mean,
yeah,
maybe one out of every million writers can pull that off. I mean,
right.
But the rest of us, it takes a
yeah.
lot of work, you know, for me, maybe 1,000 hours or so for a novel. And,
yeah.
you know, when I sit down and I'm about to write it, I'm like, okay, is this character someone that I want to spend the next 1,000 hours alone with?
Right.
And if they're not interesting enough to me to want to spend 1,000 hours alone with them, then, well, guess what? I'll get bored with the book, and my readers will get bored with the book.
Absolutely.
Because I was when I wrote it. So I love the aspects of dimensionality that you talk about and you know, going deeper with the character and also striving for excellence. And you know, when you're talking about reading stuff off the slush pile, something struck me recently, and that is, you know what, today there is no slush pile because someone will send it in, and then it'll get rejected, and they'll just say, you know what, I'll just self-publish it.
Yeah. Oh.
And so then it's self-published.
Self-publishing.
You know, and it's like, and Pam and I were doing some research, and we found out, I think that the last time we checked, there were 5,000 self-published books coming out per day.
Oh, I believe it. I think a statistic I read, and I think it was 2013, I'm sure it's way more now, that in that year there were close to 500,000 books self-published.
Yeah.
500,000. Who reads them?
It's absolutely stunning.
Yeah,
now, I'm not saying that
them.
They can't they can't write a good book or, you know, wherever it's published, you know, it could be good. But the thing is, they're almost never edited well or refined well. It's almost always like, well, I can't sell it, so I'll just self-publish it, or whatever it is. And so, you know, for me, people ask, well, should I self-publish? I said, look, I don't know. All I know is most of the books that I've read that have self-published were published way too soon. Maybe the kernel of the idea was great.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe it was, you know, I'll say to someone, maybe you need another dozen or so more drafts. And they'll stare at me like I just, you know, shot their newborn or something. I'm like, no, really. I mean, it's a good idea. Just need another 500 hours on it.
It's so true. It's so true. I mean, this is probably a horrible thing to say, but one of the things that kills me is the fact that, again, because we want things that are easy, that the whole self-publishing industry that makes it seem so easy and seem like a good idea, people who I think that I'm surprised are touting the idea of self-publishing, it just kills me because it's even if you're the one in 500,000 who is good, how are people even going to find out it's there? Are you going to be a marketer
right.
now?
Right.
I know. And then that's it. They'll say, oh, you've got to spend 30 hours a week marketing or something.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what? What? I'm a storyteller, man. I'm not a salesman.
No, exactly. It's a completely different skill. I mean, 100%. And also, it's stacked against you because there's so much rotten stuff out there.
I know.
You know, it's just. I mean, I could not agree with you more. And I think that, I mean, do bad books get traditionally published? Of course. you know. But self-published books, I mean, if you want to publish it for yourself and for your family and to give it to your friends, that's, you know, that's fine. But otherwise, putting in a little bit more work and really trying can make all the difference.
Your can make a huge, right. huge difference, yeah.
Yeah, and then self-publish. You know, I mean, I get that if Stephen King wanted to self-publish, he could, you know, or you could bury a book under a rock and people are going to dig it up because they know who you are. It's not the same for somebody who has no name, even if they
yeah.
are good.
And there's so many promises being made. That's what really frustrates me. So many people like, well, I think I'll just self-publish it and sell it because so-and-so sold, you
right.
know, half a million or a million copies or something. But they're not being told that, you know how many did
yeah.
not sell that. I think 90% of self-published books don't even sell 50 copies.
Yeah,
someone told me this crazy statistic, and I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
He's like, no, actually, I'm not kidding you. So,
yeah. No,
so
I've,
you know, whatever route people take, we want them to tell excellent stories.
Yeah, I mean,
and,
also because
yeah.
stories are how we change the world. When you hear a story, that's when people talk about mindless entertainment. There's no such thing as mindless entertainment.
I like that.
It enters through your gut. You feel it. It looks out through your eyes. The only way it's mindless is you don't think about it. Stories change how we see things every minute of every day because it's how we process information. So, I mean, writers are the most powerful people on the planet for that reason. You are changing people. Every story you hear, you read, you watch is changing you in ways large and small. Every commercial that you watch, politicians know it, advertisers know it, and somehow writers haven't quite grasped that yet. But, yeah, stories change us every minute of every day. So if you do harness it and take the time to really, you know, really put your character through the change, your reader's going to go through that exact same change. And they're going to see the world differently when they finish the book. And that's why when you think about what's my point, what am I trying to say, really what you're saying is, what's my point? How do I want to change how people see things? What do I want to open up their eyes to? What do I want to change their mind about or just give them a broader way to look at it? That's what you're doing, and that's, you know, the pen is more powerful than the sword. I mean, you know, provided someone isn't stabbing you with a sword in the moment.
I love that in your book on, I think it's page 106, but you mentioned that in October 2006, 6,000 people died worldwide from hurricane-induced floods. And you read that or you tell that to someone, they don't weep.
Right.
They
no.
don't cry. They just
they
say, oh,
pay attention.
Well, that's too bad or something.
Yeah.
And so people sometimes will ask me, well, do your books desensitize people to violence? Because there's some graphic violence in some of my novels.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I actually think my books sensitize them to violence because I let people grieve. I let it hurt. I take you to the crime scene and I let you cry with the people who are mourning or whatever. But I don't glamorize violence or I don't mute it. And I think these are the two areas where, you know, we do desensitize people to pain and to violence is when we glamorize it, make it look attractive, or when we just kind of skip over it as if it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about this illustration is, you know, go to the place and meet the people who, you know, lost someone in the flood or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the story is because that's right. where the truth is. And
absolutely,
when we write truth, we reach that emotional place where people are connecting with the world. And
yeah, that's 100%. Yeah. If you give someone a fact, you're asking them to think about it. And they don't. Why would they if they can't see why it's relevant to them? And plus, it's general, and we don't think about anything general or conceptually or abstract. We think about it specifically. So if you take that same fact and you personalize it and you make the person feel it, now that fact has meaning. Now the flood or the violence or whatever, now we go, oh, yeah, waterboard them, whatever. You know, now you're in someone's skin when they're being waterboarded, you're going to think twice about it because it is this, you know, enhanced whatever it was they called it, and they made it seem like it was nothing. You know, the euphemisms. Or what's that one that they use? The
enhanced interrogation or?
I don't even think about that. Yeah, that was enhanced. There's some term that sounds so bland. Or when they talk about people are hungry and they talk about food insecurity or something. And you're thinking, okay, that doesn't make me feel anything, but if you say there's a 3-year-old who hasn't eaten in a week,
right.
and they're, you know, and they're eating the bugs off the floor, okay, now I feel something, and it's the same thing. It only comes down to, and again, it's because, you know, we're wired to only really connect with things that we feel are going to affect us in one way or another, and that means personally and subjectively. That's what stories do. They translate those great big ideas into something super specific, and it allows us to experience it with that one system by which we make every decision we ever make, and that's our emotion. And that's the other thing that kills me is people don't understand what emotion is. That emotion is literally how we make sense of everything. And people, you know, they tend to think of emotion as being emotional, which is just, you know, one very narrow band of emotion. But emotion actually underlies everything. You know, we don't make decisions based on a rational analysis of something. We make decisions based on how the rational analysis makes us feel. And that's what it comes down to. And story makes us feel things. I mean, even when people go, you'll hear in the news, oh, he was so emotional about it, but now he's calm. And I always want to go, dude, calm is an emotion. Guess what? No feeling. And that's what it comes down to. And that's why even when people talk about, well, how does your character feel, and they'll make that mistake, happy, sad, they're jumping up and down, their heart is pounding. And it's like, no, you don't need to tell me that. If you show me how they're processing it and what they're thinking, just literally the thoughts of what will happen if, you know, if they lose their spouse or their kid was actually in the World Trade Tower when it came down, and they're just thinking about that and what it would mean to them, I'm going to be sobbing. You don't have to tell me they were crying. You know, you don't have to tell me their heart was pounding. It's in how we process the information. And that comes back to that internal struggle, which is what we're wired to respond to in everything we read. And when it's not there, when it's not affecting someone in that way, that's when it just becomes a bunch of things that happen, and then we put the book down and we never pick it up again.
Well, Lisa, as we close up here, I'd like to ask you about your book that's coming out in August. What is it titled, and what is it? How is it different than the one that is already out?
It is called Story Genius, and the subtitle, which is, like, super long, the subtitle is How to Use Brain Science to Go Beyond Outlining and Write a Riveting Novel, and then in parentheses, before you spend 3 years writing 327 pages that go nowhere, which is sadly what often happens. And really what it is Wired for Story, and the hardest part about writing Wired for Story was that it was like, okay, here's 16 different things you need to know concurrently to write something, and how do you, you know, break it down, and how do you put it in some kind of order? And I think we did that pretty well, but it wasn't 100% prescriptive. So you can kind of pull out things to do and look at, but it wasn't, okay, wait a minute, I've got this idea, now what do I do? And that's what Story Genius is. It takes you from, first of all, it talks about what a story is, and, you know, similarly to Wired for Story, so you really get that. It talks about why we have so many myths about what a story is, and it debunks that, counting, pantsing, and plotting. And then it goes into, you know, okay, what do you do from the first glimmer of an idea all the way through to now you're on your way to your first draft. And I've worked with writers, you know, with this method, and they end up with first drafts that are like a fifth or sixth draft because they've really got this backstory down. I even have, anyway, I could go on and on. But that's
no, that's great.
It's 100% prescriptive. It will really, you know, take you through from the beginning of an idea to the end. It tells you exactly kind of what to do, what to look at, and how to do it, so that it takes all the same principles from Wired for Story, and there's brain science in it also, but it's much more, okay, here's what it is. And a neat thing that we did is I worked with a novelist who was willing to take her next book and develop it within the pages of Story Genius. So you
see examples
of it, you know, all the way through being built. So I don't know. Who knows? It was the hardest thing I ever wrote.
Sounds good. So, well, we do recommend Wired for Story, and we'll look forward to your new book. And I know that you, Lisa, consult with novelists and screenwriters, and where's the best place for people to either be in touch with you or look up more information about your services? Where do they connect with you online?
It's just my website, which is simply enough, wiredforstory.com. And
all
that's
right.
Where I am.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, that was one of we've done a number of these interviews, of course, and so, but I have to say the time went faster in that interview than almost any of the others. I was just like drinking in what you said.
Oh, wow.
And I really appreciate your insights. It was great to be able to just kind of hear your thoughts played out instead of trying to do everything in snippets.
Right.
Sound bites.
Thank you, because I love that question about is it an internal change or is it just a revealing of why the character is doing what they're doing but they don't change. That's like, I I love that question. I'm going to really think about that again because I think it's the same thing. But, boy, I never thought of it that way before. So thank you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, guys, everybody, thanks for listening. And information about my books is stephenjames.net. And, of course, my next novel writing intensive retreat will be held in the fall in Dallas. And information is at novelwritingintensive.com.
And for information about my editing services, you can go to pamtheeditor.com.
All of our guests and bios and more broadcasts are at thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.